You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Good morning and welcome to Community Living Radio here on the NCRA Networks and being broadcast today from UBC at CITR 101.FM here in Vancouver. I'm just having a little trouble today with speaking. It seems like I'm stumbling over my own words. Hi, good morning. This is Michael Rubin. And I think Kelly will be back next week. He's still away on assignment this week, but I'm pretty sure he'll be back next week. And we'll get to team up again and give you great information about disabilities. So today, since we're coming up on the Labor Day weekend and everything, I wasn't able to actually find a guest, which I guess that's really no surprise because everybody's trying to escape to get away for the weekend and have some fun, one last bit of summer fun for Labor Day, because that's what we all do. I'm going to play some clips today about multiple sclerosis or MS. We talk about fibromyalgia, we talk about autism, blindness, and a multitude of other types of conditions that cause disabilities. But MS is one of those that we really don't talk too much about. So I'm going to play a clip that it's a Dr. McDougall, and it says cause and cure for multiple sclerosis. And he's got some good information for folks out there. And also some information, you know, you're not the only ones that may be going through this too. So let's play the clip.
To get an autoimmune disease, have you thought about autoimmune diseases in the past? Well, I remember thinking about autoimmune diseases myself, and what I was taught probably in high school, certainly in medical school, is this is a situation where the body attacks itself. Autoimmune disease, the body attacks itself. And I would think, how stupid of the body to attack itself? Why would it do that? It doesn't make any sense for the body to attack itself. Well, the reason it attacks itself is a consequence of injury to the body. And I'll show you how I believe it works, and the scientific research is solid supporting this mechanism, and probably most of you know this already. The first thing you have to do to get the body to attack itself is you have to damage the barrier between the body and the outside world. And the connection between the outside world and the inside of the body is with a one layer of cells in the gut. It's a single layer. What you find, here you have the intestinal contents. That's where the partially digested food throws through the gut. And to get into the body, you have to go through this one cell layer. This one layer of cells, single layer of cells. And once it goes through this single layer of cells that you see right here, then whatever nutrients or other substances get through this single layer of cells, now it's into the body. It can be picked up by the veins and carried throughout the rest of the body. But it has to go past this one barrier. And this barrier is very smart. This gut barrier is so smart that it can distinguish between harmful proteins like those in viruses and bacteria and necessary proteins that the body absorbs to supply its protein needs. It can make that distinction. That little cell layer is so smart that it can increase nutrient intake based upon its needs. Let's take a nutrient, for example. Iron. Some of you learned this in medical school and dietetic school, that when you're iron deficient, say you had a bleeding problem, what happens is the gut gets very aggressive at absorbing iron and picks up extra iron from the gut and meets the iron needs. Now, that's important to get extra iron in, but what if your iron is sufficient? What if you have plenty of iron in the body and you eat a diet with plenty of iron in it, sufficient iron, and you have sufficient iron in the body? The gut has to make a decision to keep that excess iron out of the body, because if it allowed it in, what would happen is you'd get iron deposits throughout the body, a condition called hemochromatosis. Your spleen and liver would get very sick and you would die. So that one cell layer makes that discrimination. That one cell layer also discriminates, for example, with calcium. If you eat a lower calcium diet, and there's no such thing as a too low calcium diet. So what happens is the body makes a decision with that one cell layer to absorb sufficient calcium to meet its calcium needs. If you do things that may seem foolish to this audience, and that is you take calcium pills or drink glassfuls of milk, what happens is that one cell layer makes a decision to keep that extra calcium out of the body. If it wasn't able to make that discrimination, that extra calcium would go into the body. You develop soft tissue calcification. Your kidneys, your heart, other organs would become calcified, and you'd die. Okay, the point being is this is a very important barrier that makes some decisions, unconsciously, of course, that protect us and keep us in good health. If this layer gets damaged, then what happens is we get into a situation where things get into the body that aren't supposed to be in the body. You develop a leaky gut. You've heard that term, leaky gut. All right, you develop a leaky gut. Once you have passed the barriers of the body, say the respiratory cells that has a layer of discrimination, or the GI cells that I just showed you with a layer of discrimination, once this something gets into the body that's not supposed to be there, the body launches its second defense, which is the immune system. Like, for example, you've got a virus that gets through your respiratory tract or your GI tract. It gets through this one cell layer of discriminating cells. Now it's floating around the blood. What the body has to do now is deal with that foreign substance, in this case, proteins, the viral coat proteins. So the next line of defense is the body produces antibodies. Its lymphocytes produce antibodies that are directed to that particular protein, foreign protein that got in the body, in this case, a virus. And the antibody response is very specific. These antibodies produced by the lymphocytes are very specific to deal with this sequence of amino acids and this viral coat of this particular protein. It's like a lock and key. You get a foreign protein into the bloodstream, the body makes antibodies specific to that particular sequence of amino acids on that particular protein, so it can destroy the virus. Other foreign proteins get in the body besides viruses and bacteria and so on. Food protein, if you have a leaky gut, like beef protein, can get into the bloodstream. So now you've got a foreign protein floating around the blood, beef. The body recognizes this is foreign, like a virus coat or a bacterial cell wall, and it makes antibodies to that beef protein. Very specific, those antibodies, to that particular sequence of amino acids on that particular beef protein or pork protein or dairy protein. Dairy protein gets into the body. The body gets through that gut, that leaky gut. The body makes antibodies to the dairy protein, attacks that foreign protein in the bloodstream, and gets rid of that foreign protein like it would a virus, etc. All right. The problem occurs here. This is how you get autoimmune diseases. Is in the effort to defend itself against these foreign proteins, the body makes antibodies that attack the milk protein, but they're not just specific to the milk protein. They cross-react with proteins in our own body. It's a process called molecular mimicry. Molecular, molecules, mimicry, copy. The body produces antibodies against this foreign protein milk, but it finds similar sequences of amino acids on the human tissues in the body. And so because of this cross-reactivity, it's trying to attack the milk, but it finds similar sequences of amino acids on other tissues, like, for example, the pancreas. And as a result, looking for these foreign proteins, this cow milk protein, it finds similar sequences of amino acids. And in this case, the beta cells of the pancreas that produce insulin. And these antibodies specifically produced to deal with this sequence of amino acids finds the same sequence of amino acids that's found on dairy in the beta cells of the pancreas. This, by the way, was published in 1992 in the New England Journal of Medicine. They identified 17 amino acids in a sequence that's present on beta casein and also present on the surface cells of the insulin-producing cells of the pancreas. So what happens is the child, usually a child, in fact, half the people who get type 1 diabetes are under 18, half are older 18. What happens is the person consumes the cow milk. Because the gut is injured, because that one lining is injured, what happens is that cow milk protein can get into the body. The body makes antibodies to that cow milk protein. Those antibodies are not specific. They cross-react through a process of molecular mimicry. They find the same sequence of amino acids on the insulin-producing cells of the pancreas. That's how you get type 1 diabetes. Now, how did that layer of cells get injured? It gets injured by the typical American diet. It gets injured by environmental chemicals. It gets injured by viruses. It gets injured by drugs, like non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. And what happens is it injures that one cell layer. That one cell layer goes from here to here. One cell layer. You can recognize this. Just remember the time you drank a hot drink, and you burnt the inside of your mouth. And you looked inside, and you saw this denuded area of cells. That's that one cell layer. It hurt terrible, worse than you ever expected from just that little burn. But you've lost that single layer of cells. And these cells, they become denuded, ineffective, you develop the leaky gut. And that's caused by various things that we come in contact. And I do want to mention there's one other common condition which is talked about a lot these days, and that's celiac disease. People with celiac disease, they develop a leaky gut as a consequence of gluten, which is from wheat, barley, and rye. And people with celiac disease have a very high incidence of multiple autoimmune diseases because they have this injury to that one cell layer. All right. So that's how you get typical autoimmune diseases. You injure that one cell layer, foreign proteins get into the bloodstream, the body produces antibodies to those foreign proteins. Unfortunately, there are similar sequences of amino acids present on your own tissues. And those tissues can be tissues of the joints, colon, pancreas, kidneys, skin, all kinds of tissues. And as a result, you get these autoimmune diseases like ankylosing spondylitis, Crohn's disease, dermatomyositis, type 1 diabetes, various kinds of inflammatory arthritis, multiple sclerosis, myasthenia gravis, psoriasis, rheumatoid arthritis, thyroiditis. It just depends upon where this cross-reactivity takes place. And you can destroy the cells of the skin, the pigment cells. You can destroy the neurologic cells and so on as a consequence. That's how you get autoimmune diseases. But when it comes to multiple sclerosis, you have to cause one further injury. You see, the barrier to the outside world when it comes to the nervous system, there are two barriers. One is the gut, which I just talked to you about. Once the foreign protein gets into the blood, the body makes antibodies against this foreign protein. These antibodies can't affect the nervous system unless they cross one more barrier, and that's called the blood-brain barrier. Between the blood and the spinal fluid is a barrier called the blood-brain barrier. So not only do you have to have the injury to the gut to get multiple sclerosis, where the foreign protein gets into the bloodstream, the body makes antibodies, but those antibodies produced against that foreign protein have to get into the nervous system by damaging the blood-brain barrier. And here's what Dr. Swank thought caused the damage of the blood-brain barrier. He published a paper in Circulation in 1954 describing what he believed to be the problem. Right here in Portland, he did this research. And I just want you to read the title. It's called Intervascular Aggregation and Adhesiveness of Blood Elements Associated with Alimentary Lipemia. You all know what that means. Well, you do. You really do. Intervascular aggregation and adhesiveness of blood elements, blood cells, red blood cells, white blood cells, platelets, etc. The aggregation of these elements caused by gut fat, alimentary lipemia. And what Dr. Swank said is this has an effect on the blood-brain barrier, and he publishes the results in the American Heart Association Journal Circulation. And what he showed
is that you, remember I told you this is a perivascular disease that occurs around the blood vessels, these inflammatory attacks that you get multiple scars. So what he showed is, in his research, he showed how you injured the blood vessels and how as a result you destroy the blood-brain barrier and things leak out. You know, these antibodies can get into the nervous system. He showed that in 1954, Dr. Swank did. Okay, this is what Dr. Swank showed in the 1950s in his animal experiments. This is the blood elements, the blood cells flowing through the blood of, in this case, it happens to be a hamster cheek pouch. So you see the rapid flow of blood, and then what happens is they feed this particular animal, feed them fat. I know this is a violation of animal rights, but they did. They fed fat, the fat coated the blood cells, and now the blood cells, they stick together. The reason they stick together is naturally blood cells, they have an ability to repel each other. They have a negative charge, and when they hit, they bounce off each other. But when you feed the fat, what happens is the fat coats the red blood cells, and it prevents them from repelling each other, and they adhere together, and they form this sludging phenomena that I just showed you. And this sludging phenomena lasts for about 10 hours. Now, that's what Dr. Swank showed in hamster cheek pouches, but the same thing has been shown in human beings. Like, for example, Dr. Friedman's work that was published in the same journal, Circulation, back in the 1960s. Dr. Friedman, what he did is he took, in this case, a fireman, took multiple subjects, published it in the journal, Circulation, set up an experiment where they could look at the circulation directly, and that's to look in the conjunctiva, the whites of the eye, set up the microscope, took this gentleman and several others in the experiment, and fed him one meal, one high-fat meal. The meal happened to be 67% fat. This one meal consisted of 2 eggs, 4 strips of bacon, milk, cream, bread, 2 pats of butter. Any of you ever eat that? Okay, this man had one meal. This is the conjunctiva of the eye. You see the large amount of circulation here. Prior to the meal, he was fed this one high-fat meal, and you see the dramatic reduction in circulation that took place in 4 hours. I want you to note, this is animal fat we're talking about. When they did the experiments that were published likewise in a major medical journal, using vegetable fat, the sludging was more severe and more prolonged using vegetable fat than animal fat. So what happens is you eat these proteins, animal proteins, in this case what we're talking about, beef protein, dairy protein, etc. The gut gets damaged either because of drugs or viruses or chemicals or whatever. It gets damaged. You develop a leaky gut. Now the animal protein gets into the bloodstream. The body makes antibodies to these animal proteins. Maybe dairy. In fact, in the animal experiments, what they find is that a protein on beta casein, a milk protein, causes the production of antibodies to the beta casein, the milk protein, that then have the ability to attack the proteins of the nervous system. And so these antibodies that are produced in the bloodstream, they go into the nervous system, and they attack the myelin sheaths of the nervous system, which is the hallmark of multiple sclerosis. Okay? Because of molecular mimicry, this cross-reactivity. And when you destroy the myelin sheath, the proteins over the nerves, what happens is the nerves don't function well, and that's how you get MS. I learned this philosophy from Dr. Swank many years ago. I met several patients along the ways of his, like, for example, this lady, Donna McFarland. She was told she had some of the worst multiple sclerosis her neurologist had ever seen. And here she is 20 years later with Dr. Swank, doing wonderful. And then I met this lady, Deb Tissack. She has kind of an interesting story. She developed MS in 1991. The area of dysfunction was in her inner ear. She developed extreme dizziness, vertigo. Got so sick, she couldn't even go see the doctor. She finally got well enough to go see the doctor about a month later. Her husband took her in to see the doctor. The family doctor said, this is far beyond anything I can take care of. You must see a neurologist. She went to see the neurologist. The neurologist checked over, called her husband into the room, sat down with the two of them and told her, you have multiple sclerosis, Deb. And what this means, he turned around to a blackboard, not a great bedside manner, turned around to the blackboard, drew an X here and said, this is where you are now in terms of function. In 5 years, this is where you're going to be in a wheelchair. And in 10 years, here is where you're going to be bedridden or dead. And Deb said, I think there's something I can do better. She became semi-vegetarian in 2000, started our diet in 2001, and she stopped multiple sclerosis in 2002. Now, how do we know she stopped the multiple sclerosis in 2002? Because she got serial MRIs. And her MRIs showed, like, for example, this one, compared to 2000, the multiple lesions in the brain described above are slightly smaller and do not show any interval increase in size. So I'm running into these various patients. I have a friend called Dr. Roy Swank, who has studied 5,000 people over 50 years using diet to treat multiple sclerosis. That's where my level of interest was. There is no other option than dietary change. I'm not going to go into the discussion of drug therapy of multiple sclerosis, but I can just tell you, it's criminally expensive, extremely ineffective, and relatively toxic. Dr. Swank, he developed the Swank diet. What he developed was a low saturated fat diet. Now, do you know what saturated fat is? Industry uses the word saturated fat to confuse you. You know what saturated fat is. Saturated fat is meat, dairy, and eggs. So he developed a diet that was low in total fat, low in saturated fat, in other words, very low in animal food intake. He used some vegetable fat, and he fed them starches, vegetables, and fruits. Dr. Swank thought that giving fish oil was good. And I had this conversation with Dr. Swank many times about why fish oil was good. And he said, well, he thinks that it makes the diet tastier. And keeps the people warmer, because they have a little more body fat up here in Portland. I said, well, does it do anything in terms of the disease? No, it doesn't. It's getting the saturated fat out that makes the difference. So even though when you hear about the Swank diet, you'll hear, well, Dr. Swank feeds some omega-3 fats to these people. Yeah, but not to have any effect on the disease. No limits to starches, vegetables, and fruit. That is the Swank diet.
Dr. Swank found that a difference of 8 grams of saturated fat, 8 grams of saturated fat resulted in a threefold increase in the chance of dying of multiple sclerosis, and he published that in 1990. 8 grams of saturated fat. What's that? 8 grams of saturated fat increases the risk of dying of multiple sclerosis threefold.
What is 8 grams of saturated fat? If you have one sausage a day, that's 10 grams of saturated fat. You increase your risk of dying of multiple sclerosis by threefold. You have one burger, 3 times the risk of dying of multiple sclerosis. One porterhouse steak, 3 times a day, just one. Oh, let's see, a chicken McNugget. 3 times the risk of dying of multiple sclerosis. A little cheese, 3 times the risk of dying of multiple sclerosis. A little cheesecake, 3 times the risk of dying of multiple sclerosis. No, it's not a lot of this saturated fat you have to eat to change the course of your disease. Or it's not a lot you got to get out of your diet to save your life. All right. Let's talk about some of the results of Dr. Swank's diet. Again, I have had many discussions. I was fortunate enough to record some of these discussions. We talked about the effects of his diet on multiple sclerosis. Remember, any other treatment, within 10 years, half the people are unable to walk unassisted, wheelchair-bound, bedridden, or dead. I don't care what kind of drug you throw at them. I don't care if you spend $30,000 a year treating them. It doesn't make any difference. They're in huge trouble. So what's Dr. Swank's result? Well, Dr. Swank reports, with a Swank diet, relapses decreased by 70% in the first year of treatment. Now pay attention to this, because you're going to hear it again. From one relapse per year to 0.2 of a relapse per year. And he says that after the first year, there were continued improvements, about 5% fewer relapses per year for the next 2 years. Okay, let's hear what...
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Halkomelem-speaking Musqueam people.
What's up, man? Hey, I'm on the guest list. Yeah. Who's headlining here tonight? Yeah, I'm on their list. Oh, well, I should be on there, so...
Looking for that cool band Buzz?
Jeez, I don't know what to tell you.
Chindig is CITR's annual Battle of the Bands. Every year, Vancouver bands compete for prizes including studio time, festival spots, media coverage, promotions, and more. We are now accepting submissions. Please send your demo of original material of at least 3 songs to shindig.submissions@gmail.com. Contact info must include your email and phone number. All genres welcome. Join a 33-year-old legacy of great Vancouver music. For more info, find the CITR Shindig page on Facebook.
There's only one way that old clunker is going to make you feel good again. Donate it to Bullying Canada. Check this out. Free towing or pickup of your old vehicle, a tax-deductible receipt, and a super easy process. Online at bullyingcanada.ca. Get rid of that old vehicle and feel good about supporting real solutions for change in your community. Donate your old or used vehicle to Bullying Canada today. Full details online at bullyingcanada.ca.
So, we listened to Dr. McDougall talk about the swank diet and the effects of diet on MS and how just simple changes in diet can help us live a better life if you have MS. I thought it was kind of interesting that one sausage, one burger, one steak could actually make a life-changing effect on your life. Just interesting information. So the next clip is from All Things Abigail, and she's talking about a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis, and she's. This was posted after she went through for 2 weeks trying to work out the diagnosis and things like that. So let's go on to this next clip, and here we go.
Hi guys, so I know it's been a few weeks since I've done any videos, and there's a long list of things I'd like to be posting, some reviews and some different things, but I wanted to give an update as to where I've been. It's been kind of a crazy couple weeks, and just within the last 3 weeks, I've had some really life-altering events happen to me, and I figured I'd share those with you, and then hopefully I can get back to doing my regular posts. Back on the week of about November 12th or so, I woke up one morning feeling kind of strange. My skin was really hypersensitive, like it hurt to the touch. If you just touched my arm or my hand or really anywhere, it would send me almost in crying out in pain. It was really, really very sensitive. Half my body felt like I was sitting on a heater, while the other half felt like it was freezing cold. Just really bizarre. I thought I was going crazy. I've had this happen a couple times now that I look back. Within the last 8 months or so, but nothing this severe. It would be for very brief periods of time, less than a day, and then it was gone. And I kind of always thought it was something to do with my neck, pinched nerve, or whatever. So when I felt this coming on, I thought, okay, this is a pretty bad case of it. I just got to take it easy for a couple days, and it'll go away. Well, after about 2 days of that, I woke up one morning, got out of bed, it almost fell to the floor. My legs felt like they were jello. Another really strange sensation. They just were very weak and almost felt like they wouldn't be able to hold my weight. Throughout the next day or so, it started getting worse. My right leg was very bad. It got to the point where I was really just dragging the leg behind me. It was kind of dead, I guess you could say. I couldn't lift it up off the ground. I couldn't even pick it up 2 inches off the ground. It just kind of hobbled around behind me. I was limping really bad. I couldn't walk for long distances. I had trouble like carrying my daughter because I was too afraid I was going to fall and drop her. During that time, about the second day of this weakness in my leg, my right arm started to go numb. My skin was still pretty hypersensitive in different areas, but my fingers started to act up. My right arm started to go almost as dead as my leg. I could move the arm, but my fingers were very strange. I couldn't bend them too well. By Friday, my fingers were kind of like this. My fingers were like hooked. Could this, if I was telling my body straighten your fingers, this is how straight they would be. Couldn't do anything with them. Extremely numb and just really kind of scary. So on that Friday, I went to my chiropractor thinking it's a pinched nerve. Somebody's got to fix it. And he told me, not a pinched nerve. And if it is, we really need an MRI so we can see where it is. So he recommended I go to. So I had a friend of mine take me to the emergency room so that my husband could stay home with my daughter. And I spent 8 hours there. I got a CAT scan, I got some x-rays, I got a whole bunch of blood work. During that time, I was like, my body was freezing. I felt like I was standing in a snowbank. From my legs down, everything was just kind of achy and uncomfortable and hypersensitive, and I couldn't move my leg, and I was afraid I was gonna fall. My arm was killing me, and it just was the scariest thing ever. They sent me home from the ER about 7 o'clock that night, telling me they ruled out everything acute. Wasn't gonna die today. They didn't see a brain tumor, anything like that, on the CAT scan or x-ray. I could go home. And they recommended I follow up with a neurologist. So, made an appointment with a neurologist, and I think I saw him on about Tuesday, I guess. By then, I was just getting worse. My arm, I couldn't hold my daughter. I couldn't pull the tabs on her diaper to get her dressed. I couldn't hardly get myself dressed. Couldn't tie my shoes. I could hardly walk. I was a mess. So Tuesday I went and saw the neurologist, and he got me scheduled for an MRI the following day. He was pretty freaked out, wanted to get me in right away, which was good, but scary nonetheless. He had mentioned MS. He thought multiple sclerosis is probably what we're looking at here. Kind of overwhelming, but okay, as long as I know what it is, we can deal with it. So Wednesday I went in for the MRI, and I had to drag myself there. My husband drove me. I'm sitting in the MRI waiting room. I'm the youngest person by 30 years at least. And it was just kind of, it was kind of scary, eye-opening, you know, being 25 years old and having to sit in a doctor's office waiting to have an MRI of my brain done. And all these people that were in their 60s, 70s, 80s were all moving better than me. I had all these little old ladies looking at me as I hobbled my way into the office because I could hardly walk. I had an appointment to get the MRI results the following Wednesday, so a week later. That day, my mom had called and said she was going to fly in from Massachusetts, so she was flying in Thursday. Thursday night after she got here, I got a call from the doctor's office telling me my MRI results were in and they didn't want me to wait till Wednesday. They wanted me to come in the following day, Friday. Okay, so Friday morning, my mom, my husband, my daughter, and two of my great friends, one who's a nurse, went into the office with me. We all packed ourselves into the small room and got the results. It looks like MS. You can't really prove MS with just a blood test or something like that. There's nothing that just says it's MS. They have to rule everything else out first. And to my benefit, I guess, they were seeing a lot of lesions on my scan. Not the most, the doctor said, but an awful lot. So that's a little scary. I had a ton on my brain and on my spine. And it all was pointing towards MS. It didn't look like there was anything else, but they wanted to have me admitted to the hospital to do a strong dose of steroids for 3 days and get a lumbar puncture. Okay, sorry about that. Abigail decided she was up from her nap. Let's see if we can get a few minutes in before I gotta feed her lunch. So on Friday afternoon, I was admitted to the hospital to start my steroid IV treatment. That was kind of the hardest part because I had to leave her for 3 days. It actually ended up being almost four. I spent, you know, the next Friday night, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday morning at the hospital getting the IV treatment. My leg had gotten progressively worse. Spent most of the time in the hospital bed. My arm was just horrible. It was a serious struggle trying to get dressed, trying to do anything, shower, I mean, brush my teeth. I couldn't squeeze the toothpaste. I couldn't even hold the toothbrush with my right hand. It really just was one of the scariest things I've ever gone through. Towards the end of the weekend, after being on the IV treatment, I did get a little bit of progression. My leg got a little better. I was able to lift my leg off the floor before I left the hospital on Tuesday. My arm was still pretty bad, but maybe my fingers could move a little bit better, not freely by themselves, but, you know, maybe a couple at a time or something, a little bit better than they were. So that was all positive things. Of course, you know, when you want a mile and you only get a foot, it's a little disheartening, but I wasn't going to let it get me down. I had this little girl to get home to, and I needed to get better for her. So since then, I went through Thanksgiving with my mom here and our friends helping me. We had a great Thanksgiving. It was a wonderful time. I was feeling a little bit better. One of the symptoms that I had that was really pretty awful was, it's called the MS hug. It's like a tight rubber band squeezing around your midsection, and it's really uncomfortable. It feels like you have your ribs jutting out of your side, and it's really tight, and it makes it really hard to get comfortable. I have to just lay on my back. Laying on my side was really kind of painful, and it got worse as the day progressed. If I overworked too much or did too much, which I tend to do anyways, because I just try to plow through everything that I need to get done and just deal with whatever pain or discomfort I'm in, it just kind of made things a lot worse. Where I am right now, I'm doing much better than I was just a week ago, just even 2 days ago. My leg is all but back to normal. I'm walking pretty normally. To me, I feel a difference, but if you didn't know me or see me walking all the time, you probably wouldn't notice that there was anything wrong. I got some really great sneakers. I might do a review on them. That really, as soon as I put them on, they just helped me walk so much better. My hand, I can move my fingers, and that's great. I have finger strength back in them, but both my hands are completely numb. The fingers and everything is so numb. And that makes things you wouldn't realize really difficult. It's difficult to type. A lot of times I may not realize that I'm hitting a key, and I am. It makes things like they're not coordinated. And I'm scratching my face or whatever is just, it's awkward. I'm doing better at getting my daughter dressed. I can hold her more. Don't hold her for too long because my arms get really tired. They get very fatigued. Using a mouse, I've had to start using my left hand with the mouse instead of my right because my left is a little better than the right. And from that, my arm gets really tired and worn out. And it's really difficult to do a lot of things, especially because I own my own print shop. And so I do a lot of design work, a lot of typing. I'm always on the computer. So that kind of makes it pretty awful. You know, when you're sitting in a chair all the time, if your leg doesn't work as much, it's kind of okay. But when you need your fingers, you need them. So that's a little discouraging, but the doctor says it may still get better. I'm still got about 3 days left on my prednisone that I have from at home. And after that, I'm going to be ending up getting injectable medicine that I have to give myself a shot every single day for the rest of my life. It's kind of a little scary, but I'm trying really hard not to get down with this. I'm just trying to keep up my spirits, and it's not something I ever anticipated getting or having, but it's not going to rule my life, and it's just going to be a part of it. And I fully plan on doing everything that I want to do with my life and being able to be the best mom that I can be for Abigail without letting it get me down. If you don't know what multiple sclerosis is, you can check out my blog. I've been doing a lot of blogging on it. What it is it's an autoimmune disease where my immune system attacks the myelin sheath, which is the coating around your nerves, your central nervous system, your spinal cord, your brain. And it starts creating lesions in that sheath, which attributes for your numbness, maybe some loss of vision, slurred speech, all different kinds of symptoms. And the steroids help to repair that damage. And then the injections help to slow down the progression. It's not something I'll ever be able to get rid of. It's not something that'll ever be fully gone or cured. I could go months or years without another flare-up, which is what I'm hoping for, but nobody ever knows when or how severe your next flare-up is going to be. It could be simple, like a migraine, maybe just one numb foot. It could get much worse. There are many people who live decades and decades without having it affect them severely. Other people end up being wheelchair-bound. I'm looking for the first route where I'll be going for the rest of my life with no problems, but I'm going to work on a few different things, my medicine, diet, exercise, whatever I can find that I can help to slow this thing down and not let it get me down is what I'm going to be doing. So I kind of just wanted to give that update. I know it's going to be kind of a long spiel here, but that's...
Music Waste and CITR are proud to announce the 2016 Victory Square Block Party. This free day of music features Morning Coup, Milk, Jody Glenham and the Dreamers, SBDC, Pale Red, and Tough Customer. There's good tunes, good food, raffle prizes, and more.
Yeah.
So come down to Victory Square this September 4th from 2 to 9 p.m. For more information, go to victorysquareblockparty.com.
Shuttle is going 2 times the speed of sound at the moment.
Oh, man.
What?
I really wanted to catch that football game, but I have to clean my room. I'm so bummed.
Yo, man, totally chill out. You can catch it on CITR.
CITR?
Did someone say CITR?
Yeah.
CITR Radio brings you Thunderbird Sports on the weekends. Catch all the action and don't miss a moment of play with our live play-by-play and color commentary. Only on CITR 101.9 FM.
Wow, that's great.
And if you can't catch the game, tune in at 3:30 p.m. every Thursday for our weekly update on UBC Athletics with live scores, recaps, and in-depth analysis.
Oh, okay, dude. Okay, dude. We get it.
Dude!
Only on CITR.
And today, we're back here on NCRA Networks, and you're listening to Community Living Radio. And today, we've been talking about, or listening to clips about dealing with multiple sclerosis. And we heard one doctor talking about changes in diet and how it can make a significant change in quality of life and things like that. Then we heard from another young lady talking about how multiple sclerosis has changed her life and how she's using medication to deal with it. So we're going to go to another clip. And these two doctors are going to be talking about the ketogenic diet and multiple sclerosis. So here we go.
With MS World, I'm Dr. Daniel Cantor. A lot of what we hear at these medical conferences has to do with medications. Some of it has to do with how MS works. And other things have to do with symptoms, as well as diet and what we can do for multiple sclerosis. I'm so happy to be joined by Dr. Marcus Bach, who works at Charity Medical Faculty in Berlin. Tell me, what did you find in your study? What were you looking at exploring?
We are looking actually if diet, especially the ketogenic diet or prolonged fasting, has an impact on quality of life in multiple sclerosis patients, and even if they have an impact on the lipid profile.
So explain to people, because some people might not be familiar with ketogenic diet. We hear about ketogenic diet with epilepsy, with people with seizures sometimes, but what exactly is the ketogenic diet?
Well, ketogenic diet is known in neurology for a long time, since 1920s, if it was invented to help in seizures. But now we found in research that ketogenic diet also has an impact on neurodegenerative disease and on neuroprotection. So ketone bodies mediate maybe more neuroprotection.
So what did you find in the study?
Well, we included 60 patients, and we found that those patients on a ketogenic diet had increased quality of life, especially physical function and pain. They had reduced pain.
So they had reduced pain from the diet itself. Now, some people think the ketogenic diet is too hard to do, that it's almost like fasting yourself. Were people able to actually complete the study?
From 20 patients on the ketogenic diet group, 18 completed the study, and even after study end, 80% of those who started or who were on the ketogenic diet continued this diet.
Yeah, does it look like the ketogenic diet actually helps the MS itself or just the quality of life?
Well, right now we did the study as an outlook for feasibility. Of course, we think that there may be some mode of action which is useful and therapeutic.
This is actually very exciting because in recent years we've seen a lot of new data about diet. Several years ago we heard about one of the diets that's a low-fat vegan diet, the McDougall diet. And after a year, it didn't help the MS relapses or MRI, but it reduced cholesterol, reduced blood pressure, and improved fatigue. So that's exciting data, and this is really exciting. In 6 months, you were able to see something like this. Ketones are important because the human brain can handle both glucose, sugar, as well as ketones. And that's why people like Gandhi, who was able to fast for years, you know, for days and days and days, was able to still be thinking clearly. So this is an exciting avenue. We look forward to seeing you at future meetings and hearing about how this may actually help people with multiple sclerosis.
Thank you so much.
Around the
world. So, and you just heard about the ketogenic diet and how it actually works because your body and brain can fuel itself from off of ketones as well as sugars, and the ketones actually help protect the brain. That's pretty interesting stuff. So we're going to have time for one last clip before we have to go. And this one is symptoms from, it's multiple sclerosis, from symptoms to diagnosis. And this one is by Marlo Donato. And I guess she's going to talk about her story. So keep listening.
What it was like for me when I first found out that I had MS, because I think one of the most traumatic points in an MSer's life is the actual diagnosis, and maybe a year afterwards. Sometimes, you know, with some people it doesn't quite hit right away. But the kind of symptoms that I had involved a lot of double vision, hallucinations, obviously, you know, bumping into things, tripping on the street quite a lot. And all these things for me added up to two options. Either I had a tumor or I had MS. And it was like in a span of, I would say, 5 months that all these symptoms started. And, you know, my life was a bit mad. At the time, I had to go on a business trip to Paris, and I had an eye patch on. And it was just so surreal. I mean, I would sit at these business meetings, and my French is not that great. So we had these little headphones on that the gentleman in front would be speaking, and we'd have this headset translating to English. At the same time, I felt like champagne bubbles were exploding in my head, and if I took the patch off, then you know, there was two of this man talking. Could your twin please move to the side? Everything was just, you know, flying into each other. It was so crazy. And I just remember sitting there with this headset thing in my ear, and I was like, what the hell is happening to me? I think I am dying. It was crazy. I mean, it's funny now. At times I laughed, and at times I didn't. Actually, on that trip, I also had an experience. I don't know if anyone else has had this, where you don't sense where your mouth is. So I was at a dinner in this very swank restaurant called Café Marly. If you're in Paris, you must go to it. It's all red walls, like my living room, but candlelit and really, really chic. And I was sitting there eating, and as I went to take a bite, I realized I couldn't sense where my mouth was. And it's something that had happened to me a few weeks before that, where I was sitting with a friend, and I went to take a bite, and I smeared it on my face. So being that I was at a dinner with colleagues and my bosses, I really didn't feel like that would be appropriate behavior, and I started to panic. So I lifted. So I did a second bite like that, and then I said, you know what, fuck it. I cannot function like this. I can't sit through a whole dinner thinking about my fork. So instead, I had some champagne. And I lit up a couple of cigarettes, which I don't usually smoke, actually, but in Paris I do sometimes, and don't ask me why, that's true. And I just smoked and drank champagne, and I had a really great time. That's really true, that's what happened. So anyway, I got back to London, and I knew through research and you know, as the MRI was done and as they were asking me more questions at the hospital, and I started to know on my own they're looking for either MS or they're looking for this type of pituitary tumor. So when I actually was diagnosed, I was with my husband and my cousin. When the doctor started reading the MRI results, and he said, you have lesions, blah, 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 and this is associated with multiple sclerosis, blah, blah. So as he said this, I heard my husband and cousin just this breath come out of their bodies. And for me, I felt this feeling of such relief. And it was only because I thought, better something that I can try to fight than a tumor. So, you know, it was surreal again. Everything is always surreal, right? We walked out of the hospital, and they said to me, my husband and my cousin, you know, they were very gentle, what would you like to do now, Marlo? And I said, I think we should go to the pub and have a bloody drink. And then my husband said, oh my God, no, I don't think you should be drinking. Do you think it's, you know, it's good for the MS? And I said, at this point, what the hell does it matter? So we went to the pub and I had a gin and tonic. And that was within my first hour of knowing that I had MS. Now, I'm not condoning alcohol or alcoholism as a way of dealing with your problems. But the point is, you know, you have to have a good time as well. So I just got on with it, and that is what I did right after.
Wow. So that's quite interesting. If you've ever had the experience of not being able to find your mouth by eating or having your food slide back out of your mouth again, depending on who you're actually with, it could be quite entertaining or quite very disturbing. I've suffered from Bell palsy several times myself, so I understand not being able to sense your mouth or being able to feel yourself even chew or any of that sort of stuff because of a type of paralysis. Not the same as MS, but the situation was quite funny, as I drank something and it fell out the other side of my mouth. It was kind of funny. But we had to have a sense of humor about ourselves. And this lady, Marlo Donatano, she seems to have quite the sense of humor about herself. So I was happy to share that with you. So hopefully, like I said, I believe next week Kelly will be back, and we'll get him to share lots of stories about his time that he was away. And so I will talk to everybody here on the NCRA networks and here at CITR 101.9 FM here in Vancouver next week. Okay, bye.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.